I'm wondering how you deal in your own life with dishonor. That is to say, when your humanity is diminished, when your ideas are not appreciated, when your feelings go unnoticed, when somebody overrides your concerns with their own conceptions. I'm wondering how that goes for you when somebody diminishes your dignity. I mean, how do you like it when your 14-year-old son or daughter cusses you out in front of other people, or uses every single opportunity that life affords them to argue with you, even about things that are just relentlessly stupid, but yet they want to fight? It's almost like they're practicing to be an attorney someday, you know? Or maybe you have a spouse who constantly makes fun of you in front of other people because they themselves feel insecure. And so in order to lower you a few pegs, they mock you in public. Or have you ever had a doctor talk to you as if you were an idiot? Do you know what I mean? Like a doctor who, I mean, you have questions, right? Because you don't understand what they've said, or you don't understand the diagnosis, so you ask them to repeat things. And they roll their eyes when they have to repeat things to you, and you feel about this big. Or, you know, I have a minister friend who was caught, due to really overwork and weakness on his part, caught plagiarizing his sermons. He simply just preached things he found online and claimed them as his own. And there's a lot you can say about that. But he had an acquaintance in one of his parishes after he left parish ministry who found out about it and blasted that indiscretion all over the internet so that every single person could know. Well, he was eventually hospitalized out of psychological stress after that event. Or maybe you've dated somebody and you thought they were great, you thought they were terrific. I mean, they checked all the boxes, but then when you had certain physical boundaries that you wanted to maintain, they pressured you again and again until you gave in. And you feel dehumanized by that kind of aggression that borderlined on assault. Well, some of us in this room, really many of us, have never really recovered from the vandalism that has taken place in our own lives. We've never really bounced back from the dishonor that we've so harrowingly experienced. And I want to say, well, you have a friend. You have a friend at the core of reality. You have a friend in the golden eyes of Jesus Christ who was no stranger to dishonor, grave, horrific, nightmarish, hellish dishonor that made him entirely distinctive and yet common. Common because everybody has experienced it, but distinctive to the degree that he experienced dishonor. And I want to speak today about Philippians chapter 2, because Philippians chapter 2 deals with the psychological and mindful inner workings of Jesus Christ. The reading from Luke, on the other hand, deals with history. This is what happened as Jesus rode into town on a donkey. Philippians 2 gives us the inner workings of Jesus of Nazareth, what he knew as he was riding into town that day. And so I want to speak about Philippians chapter 2 as a descent into dishonor, like Jesus is climbing down the rungs of a ladder until he lands in the rag and bone shop of the heart, the very dark nexus of the human condition, the basement of our being. And so I want to speak about him climbing down the rungs of the ladder. Now, to do that, I'm only going to focus on the first part of Philippians 2, verses 5 through 8. But I encourage you to please take up your bulletin and let's work through it together. Paul writes, "Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." Now we'll stop there. The first rung, friends, the first rung is what we're going to call incarnation. Incarnation, or to put on flesh. Because Paul writes about this great mystery at the center of our faith, which is the infinite, the great I am, the one who spoke from the burning bush. was eventually fleshified in the form of Jesus of Nazareth. And Paul uses this language. Though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself. Now, to put this simply, that is mega high Christology, meaning the doctrine of Jesus. Mega high Christology. What do I mean by that? Well, every year, it never fails. Around Easter time, the History Channel, which is great, by great, I'd simply mean entertaining. Entertaining on two matters: what, aliens built the pyramids, and Jesus was a myth, right? It's wonderful. I mean, they spell it out so clearly. Aliens built the pyramids, Jesus was a myth. What do they mean? Well, they think that Jesus of Nazareth was a marvelous hippie sage who went around saying very nice thing to orphan children. And the orphan children were so warmed by it that they inspired adults to write about it later on. Those adults exaggerated the claims of Christ and turned Jesus into God. Right, but there was an exaggeration that took place that gave Jesus 8 promotions until he inherited a godlike status. Except not really, though, because the letter to the Philippians was written in A.D. 45. In other words, the letter to the Philippians was written before Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The earliest claim that we have about Jesus of Nazareth and his identity, his inner self, was that he was in the very form of God and equal to God. Now, that was written by a monotheist. That was written by Paul of Tarsus, who was a very devout Jew and would not threaten the monotheistic core commitment of Judaism, but believed that that same monotheistic God, right? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, could also blend himself with the human condition to the degree that Jesus of Nazareth was not just another sage, was not just another prophetic person, was not Moses 2.0, was not an upgraded David, was not an avatar, but was instead Yahweh fleshified. That was Jesus' identity, and that was heralded as early as possible. It was known as a common fact that Jesus was, yes, a man, but also more than a man. And it was known from the earliest days. And so Paul has this great mega high Christology. And notice what he says so beautifully about Jesus in this exalted status as the God-man, that he emptied himself. He didn't empty himself of being God. The word in Greek is kenosis. It means to diminish or deplete or empty. And what it means is that Jesus Christ, that is, when God enters human form, he gives up immediate access to some of the omnis. You know, omniscience, that he knows everything, omnipresent, that he's everywhere, omnitemporal, that he's in all times and all places. God limits himself to function within a human person. And so we know this from the Gospels that Jesus empties himself because, you know, when he's in Capernaum, he's also not in Jerusalem because he's in Capernaum. He's in one place at one time. Also, Jesus doesn't know everything as God the Father does. You may know this, that his disciples are quizzical about the second coming, and Jesus says, well, you got to ask somebody else, right? I don't know the day or hour. That's only God the Father. It also is true in Luke's gospel that when Jesus is a teenager, the gospel writer says that Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature. So not only does he get taller, which is expected, but he also has to learn things. That is, the 2-year-old Jesus didn't know algebra. He had to learn things like you learn things. And so God, in his incarnate form of Jesus of Nazareth, eschews the immediate access to certain divine capacities and prerogatives so that he could truly live as one of us. And therefore, we have a Christ who was willing for us, who was willing to live among us as we are. Now, on Palm Sunday, the crowds didn't want a Christ of kenosis, a Christ of shedding, a Christ of exfoliating divine prerogatives, a Christ who limits himself. What did they want? Do you remember the Iraq War under George W. Bush, what they called the original mission in Baghdad? Fascinating. They called it shock and awe. That's what the people wanted. Bomb this place into oblivion to such a degree that everybody learns their lesson and learns it permanently. Shock and awe. That's what people wanted on Palm Sunday. The Messiah is here. David's heir has finally arrived. And now things are going to be put right and put right immediately. They want shock and awe. But Jesus, even in this moment, is shedding the divine prerogatives to turn things on a dime like people expected. That's why he enters humbly on a donkey and not a charger like Muhammad did in Medina. He sheds the look of success, riding into the city humbly. You know, I think that it's remarkable that while we build towers to Babel and seek to control the heavens and understand all the sacred mysteries and be limitless, God does the opposite. God is very interested for your sake and becoming more limited. Now, maybe you've heard of this guy named Brian Johnson. I just found out about him. He's a 50-some-year-old tech entrepreneur who has dedicated himself to extending his lifespan through a very rigorous anti-aging regimen of a strict diet. He eats a lot of kale, you know, heaven help him, exercise, supplements, and very grossly, blood transfusions from his own son. I mean, it's a way to go, I suppose. In order that he might live and live and live, right, without the specter of death looming too close. Now, that's his way of being limitless, but you have yours and I have mine. Some of you students work way too hard. You study way too much. You need to watch far more Parks and Rec, or you need to develop a bad habit. But you're really starting to think that you can be all-knowing. You can know everything that you need to know if you just relentlessly study. Some of you work like fiends. You act like you have endless supplies of energy. You have three jobs to make the money that you think you're going to need, but it's actually killing you. I meet lots of people in the gym who are literally physically working themselves to death relentlessly, and it's actually injuring their bodies more than it is helping. But the thing is, don't we all like to do this? That's why people buy face putty. That's why I have facial serum, right? Facial serum so that I look eternally young, which is not working, by the way. But we want to be limitless in our own particular ways. What's marvelous about the great En Sof, the great I Am, the one who is higher than all high things, the great high king of Israel, is that he doesn't have the same preoccupation. Instead, he seeks out willingly limitation, so he empties himself. In Christ, God became a breath away from nothingness, and he did it for you. So he limits himself in the incarnation. That's rung one. So Jesus is climbing down into dishonor through the incarnation. But rung two, the kind of person he was, a servant. Paul writes in verse 7, he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant. A servant. Now, in Greek, it's doulos, which can mean servant or slave. Slave. Jesus' most hearty ambition was to be your slave, was to be your servant, was to give his life away until he had no more life to give, but to do it all. Now, I find this fascinatingly expressed in his teaching. You know, Jesus always taught that you ought to take the last seat on the bus, always, right? When you're at a fancy banquet, take the seats behind the pillar that nobody wants, right? Where you can't see anything. Take the worst seats in the house. The first shall be last. The humble shall eventually be exalted. The tale of the Good Samaritan, where it's the least likely person who takes care of the most injured man, right? But he did the right thing by doing so because he took the lowly place. And then he teaches that about himself. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And he also evidenced his servitude in his actions, where he helped people to the point of exhaustion. He befriended people who hated God. You know, he on the last week of his life, what was he thinking about? How do I serve my disciples in such a memorable way that they'll always carry this example in their heart? So what did he do? He knelt on a disgusting, dirty floor and took a basin of water and washed the grimy feet of his beleaguered apostles. And when they were scandalized, because no Jewish man would ever do that, when they were scandalized by it, he said, look, I've done this to set you an example so that you might do likewise. This is what I've been trying to say to you for 3 years, that this is where life really is. It's in the lowly place. It's in the place that nobody wants to be, at least not initially. But that's where life really flourishes, in the place of service rather than authority. Now, this is the opposite of all of my impulses. Now, I'm really not a hyper extrovert. I don't always need to be in front of people or near people, but I do love to be served by people. And that's why I love to go to restaurants, because that way I have to do nothing, right? People come to me and I don't have to get to know them. And they give me options and I choose an option. They go in some back room and cook me that option. They bring me out that option. I eat that option. And then they take my dirty plates away and clean things for me. And I don't have to talk to them again. It's so nice, right? Service. That's why Monique and I went once on a cruise to Bermuda, yeah? And when we were on the cruise, it was the best in the world because they had a champagne fountain or a wine fountain right next to a chocolate fountain, right next to a vat of bacon. And one time they were serving this like stuffed lobster dish, which was good, but I was really having a hankering for Indian food, and my waiter was Indian, and he said, "Do you like your food?" I'm like, "Yeah, but you know, I could really go for some chicken tikka masala right now." He said, "1 minute, sir." And he brought me out Indian food, and I'm like, "This is the best, and I deserve this," which I didn't, of course, not at all. But I did take it, you know, received it very warmly. And that's what I like. I like the world contoured around my needs. But Jesus is not like me, and he's not like you, for our everlasting betterment. You know, there was a very sad quote from Eva Perón, known as Evita. She was the wife of the populist president Juan Perón of Argentina, died at age 33 of ovarian cancer. And she was such a populist and so popular with the masses that 3 million people attended her funeral. It was the largest attended funeral in history up to that point. 3 million people filed through the parlor where her coffin was displayed. And this is what she wrote 3 weeks before she died about her appeal to the masses and how these people would do anything for her. She wrote these words: "I had millions at my feet. I gave my life to a multitude whom I would never meet. I thought I needed all the numbers on my side. I thought the more that loved me, the more loved I'd feel. But such things cannot be multiplied." In other words, it didn't work. Creating and curating a life in which everybody is there to serve you and your needs and your emotional beleagueredness doesn't actually lead to long-term solace. And Jesus alone knew that real life involved being deliberately decentered, and really embracing the place of humiliation. Embracing the place of great humiliation as the place of life, to be loosed from the chains of ego and the need for any form of supremacy, to become servile and small, to be the happy seed of winter wheat that falls to the ground and dies. That's what he was going to do. So he climbs down the rung of incarnation, climbs down the rung of service, and then the third rung, death. This is verse 8. He humbled himself, becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Notice it says obedient to death. In other words, he says yes to God unto the end, unrelentingly. Now, why is that important? Because my obedience is ridiculously pathetic. I am obedient up to the point of inconvenience, up to the point of slight agitation, and then I fold. I collapse like a flan in a cupboard. I'm not good at it after that. Right? I mean, I was, you know, I'm obedient as I drive until somebody cuts me off in traffic. And then my heart grows sour, right? And sometimes my words follow my sour heart, right? But I know you're more sanctified, but that's where we are, yeah? Well, he was obedient to death. And not just death, it qualifies it, right? Even death on a cross. Meaning, Jesus didn't just die of a heart attack at age 68. He died in the worst conceivable manner, at least in that day. It's impossible to conjure up a more tragic story, right? Jesus was betrayed by the master class of his own religion. He was condemned by a pagan Roman tyrant. He was manhandled by the military. He was betrayed by one of his closest trainees. He was sold for a week's wages. He was slandered by a raging mob. A lying judiciary convicted him of false charges while knowing they were false charges. When given the vote to liberate Christ or a criminal, people wanted and voted for the criminal. He was abandoned by all of his students except one. He was denied by his chief apostle. He was mocked as a failed king. And there is no more painful or agonizing death than crucifixion, where you suffocate naked in front of people who are happy to see you die. It's the worst obliteration one could imagine. Let alone the one that is experiencing all of this is the highest good. The one who was only generous, only kind, only honest, only compassionate, and people wanted him to die. Taking the highest good and giving him the worst conceivable dishonor. And so according to Philippians 2, Jesus climbs down, rung after rung, into the pit of dishonor, into the black infection of human sin. You know, Jesus was the most educated and wise man of all time. He knew the Palm Sunday exuberance wouldn't last. He knew that people would set their palms down and forget where they put them. He knew that as soon as he rode over the garments people had strewn along the road, that people would put them back on and go home and cook dinner. He knew that some in that crowd would change their opinion of him quite swiftly. And he knew that that road into Jerusalem would eventually lead to a rough throne and a crown of disgrace. That's why, by the way, Luke's gospel, it wasn't in our reading tonight, it's right before it. Luke's gospel says, as Jesus approached the city for the triumphal entry, what was he doing? How was he emoting? He was crying his eyes out, because he knew that this was not going to end well. Now, I know, clearly, that today's epistle lesson does not end in dishonor. It ends with the name above every name and every knee bowing. I know that. And we will get there, friends, but not today. Not today. Right now, we are going to watch the parade route as it marches toward the hill shaped like a skull. Now, to revert to my opening question from this sermon, how do you deal with dishonor? How do you deal with dishonor? You know, this passage is principally about Jesus and what he did, but it's also about you, because Paul begins our passage with these words, "Let this mind be in you. Let the Christ consciousness, the Christ perspective, flood your own brainwaves and start having an effect within your own perceptional life, within your own psychology. Let this mind be in you." In fact, to flesh out the immediate context, it's right before our lesson tonight, Paul writes these words, "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you not only look to his own interests, but also to the interests of others." And then he writes, "Have this mind in you." In other words, he so desperately wants to see the inner life of Jesus of Nazareth replicated in Jesus' followers so that we would reflect the ultimate good, the one who was in fact the man for others, the one who gave it all, the one who learned that true power is service rather than supremacy. I'm going to tell you about one example of this, how it was fleshed out, the mind of Christ fleshed out in the functions and inner workings of a friend of mine who was, in fact, given the brain of the humble Jesus. This event happened in 1985. She was best friends with a priest named James from her parish, and she lived next door to him in a New York City apartment complex. This priest was a Vietnam War vet who barely survived several battles. All of his friends but one died by the Viet Cong. Now later, after the war, he got ordained as an Episcopal minister. His parents, with whom he was previously estranged, actually, decided to come and visit him in his new apartment and to see his new church now that he had become more well-established. As he was tidying his apartment, and it needed tidying because he was a dude and a bachelor, as he was tidying his apartment, something horrific happened. His long-time girlfriend, recently turned fiancé, called him up in order to sever the tie and break up with him. That's obviously a very troubling thing, but it triggered something very dark and very deep in him that was from the war. Some aspect of his PTSD came alive in that moment, and he started binge drinking every bit of liquor that he had in that apartment. And when he was drunk, and when he was in fully fleshed out PTSD mode, he was dangerous, got angrier and angrier and violent, and in a near blackout rage, he smashed up that apartment. He broke his dishes, he punched the framed picture of him and his girlfriend, shattering the glass onto his hands, bloodied his fists up. He broke his furniture, he destroyed that apartment. Well, my friend, Nancy, who lived next door, heard the commotion and was very afraid. And so she didn't come over right away because she's a timid person by nature. But eventually things calmed down. So she knocked on the door saying, James, are you okay? The door was semi-ajar. She walks in only to find him blackout drunk and completely passed out on the couch. And now my friend was and is a very wealthy woman. Think wearing a Prada dress on her day off kind of wealthy, right? So there she is in 1985 in her $1,000 outfit back then. And what did she do? She started to clean the apartment. Now, first, she had to go out and buy cleaning supplies because, again, he was a dude and a bachelor and didn't own cleaning supplies. So she brought them to the house. She started to sweep up all of the broken glass. She scrubbed the blood away from the refrigerator and the walls. She swept up all the mess. She took away his broken furniture and brought her own furniture into the apartment so that he would have something around his dining room table, you know, the chairs. She put the pictures back on the wall, ran the vacuum. She spent 8 hours in the middle of the night cleaning, and she didn't sleep a wink. And then lastly, she saw that James' hands were so destroyed, and there were still shards of glass in them, so she took the shards out of his knuckles while he was passed out and bandaged the wounds after cleaning them. And after that eight-hour session of cleaning, the apartment not only looked habitable, it was more beautiful than it had ever been. Because she didn't want him to be dishonored in front of his parents. She left haggard and exhausted, her Prada dress thoroughly grimed out. But James woke up, hungover, of course, to a fastidiously clean apartment. And a day later, my friend Nancy received this note slid under her door. Dear Nancy, I really don't know what to say other than thank you. No one has ever done something like that for me before. You fixed hundreds of mistakes in one evening. You made my apartment cleaner than it's ever been. But it's more than that. It's like you also cleaned up the shadows from my life. Just think of it. My friend cleaned up my mess while I was passed out drunk. I had nothing to do with it, and you did all the work. And because of that, you made the gospel real to me because you did what Jesus does. I love you, James. Well, let this mind be in you. She had the mind of Christ, and she took someone's dishonor away, bearing it herself. Well, that's true for all of us, you know, because someone has entered our destroyed apocalyptic apartments. Someone arrived to take away your dishonor forever. And in dying so dishonorably, Jesus broke the black magic of the world. And now you are entirely and permanently forgiven and free. And because of what Jesus did, who wouldn't want to join the Palm Sunday crowd and claim him as the true and only High King? Who wouldn't want to scream Hosanna forever? Amen.